Matthew chapter 1. We are taking our first steps into Matthew tonight. Now, last week, if you remember, we had that wonderful video that gave us this outline of Matthew in 20 minutes. We just took this bird's eye view of Matthew and we saw how it was structured and laid out so meticulously. And after we were done watching the video, I gave you a couple of phrases to look for so that you can see the clues that Matthew leaves us to discern the structure he's giving to his gospel. There were two structural markers. The one that we're not going to worry about tonight is the one that goes like this: and it happened when Jesus had finished these sayings. And if you remember, that occurs at the end of each one of the five major discourses where Jesus speaks for chapters on end, because he speaks 60% of Matthew. 60% is red letter. He talks a lot and he talks in extended passages. So those five extended discourses are all set off by that phrase, when Jesus had finished saying these things, giving us a five-fold look at Jesus' new law, because he's the new Moses giving us a new Pentateuch. But we're not in those teachings, and we won't be there for a few weeks. And since we're not there yet, I want to focus on the other structural marker I gave you, and that's where Matthew wants to highlight, from that time on, Jesus began to preach in chapter 4, and from that time on, Jesus began to speak about his passion, which conveniently divides Matthew into three sections: prior to this, then from that time on to chapter 16, and from that time on from 16 to 28, so that we get something like this. We get chapters 1 through 4 introducing Jesus, identifying who he is, placing him within Israel's story with the genealogy, his birth, the visit of the Magi. Then Jesus living out Israel's story, going to Egypt and back just like Israel did, then being saved through the waters, or walking through the waters as Israel was delivered through the waters, and then being tested in the wilderness as Israel was tested in the wilderness, so that he becomes the definitive Israelite, the one who, if you will, recapitulates Israel's story in his own life. And we'll be talking about these for the next couple of weeks. We'll focus today on genealogy and birth. Then in chapter 4, from that time on, he began to teach. And we get these large sections of teaching, the Sermon on the Mount. I just can't wait to get there. So underrated, so important, maybe some of the most significant teaching Jesus ever gives that largely goes ignored because it's so challenging, lifting us to a higher righteousness, which Matthew 1 actually is going to allude to from the very beginning in the Joseph story we'll see before we're done tonight. Then the sending of the 12, those wonderful parables of the kingdom, showing that the kingdom's not quite what they expected it would be. It takes on a different form in light of what God's doing in Christ. And then after he asks, "Who do men say that I am?" And Peter says, "Well, you're the Christ." From that time on, Jesus began to teach and preach and tell them the passion is on its way. And so he continues to teach, but it's in the context of rising conflict and hostility and resistance, which ultimately leads to his betrayal, his trial, his death. And then the epilogue of the book of Matthew, Matthew 28, is his resurrection and then the Great Commission. So that's the shape of Matthew when you use that phrase, from that time on. So we're going to be looking this evening at just chapter 1, the very opening words of Matthew as we begin this journey into this story. And essentially what Matthew 1 wants to do is it wants to identify who Jesus is for us and deal with a very difficult problem that arises due to the virgin conception. So that's what Matthew 1's about, and you'll see as we go along. So let's just dive into this story with Matthew chapter 1 and the genealogy. So here you are, you're just excited, you think, boy, we're into the New Testament now, we're done with all those long lists and those boring kind of stuff, we're going to just move into this really, as one has called it, the greatest story ever told. And we think, okay, this is exciting. It's the greatest story ever told. Let's go. Here we go. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Good so far. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac the father of Jacob. Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram, click. You've turned the channel, which is what most of us would probably do. I mean, this would not be captivating storytelling for us moderns, because if you continue on, it goes for 16 verses listing name after name, many of them difficult, many hard to pronounce. Some of them we don't even know who they are. So that if we were watching TV, I can assure you, channel surfers, you'd flip here and you'd see, okay, all right, Jesus, that's cool. And then you see this list and it'd take about 20 seconds before you decide what else is on. Because this isn't the most exciting beginning, and we ask ourselves, why does Matthew begin like this? Every skillful storyteller knows if you're going to tell a good story, you got to hook them right away. Every speaker knows if you want to captivate people's attention, you got to hook them right away. Any novelist knows if you want people to read your book, you better make sure the opening chapters grab you from the beginning and make you interested in the story that's about to unfold. So why does Matthew begin like this? And what I'd like to challenge you with is I believe that the original readers would find this beginning captivating. I think that they'd find it very interesting. Don't think of a modern person with a short attention span. Think of someone without electricity, without multimedia, without Google, that has absorbed stories of their faith that go back generations. And they've heard these ancient names, and they've heard of people like Abram and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob and Judah and David and Solomon and Bathsheba and Tamar. And they've heard these stories. So for them, it's like opening an old family Bible you found in the attic that's a bit dusty, but when you open it up, there's all these marriage records and death recordings and ways to look at the people's names and think, that's a connection to me. There's a person that really matters, and you're immediately interested. And if nothing else, because all of these people are part of the stories you've heard all your life, every single name brings a whole collage, montage of stories to your attention. So you hear Abram and you think of all that he went through, and you think of here of Isaac and Jacob and so forth. So that this is actually for an ancient, a very fascinating book, but what makes it particularly relevant for Matthew's gospel is from the opening line of his book, he is building a bridge back into the ancient world in order to emphasize that the story of Jesus does not begin with Jesus. And that what's happening in the early Christian movement isn't something so brand new, it's a fad. It is something that is connected to and woven with, and indeed the climax of, generations of hope and anticipation. So that he is building this bridge and connecting to this story that is so much larger than we often think of. And in doing that, he's revealing right away that this story doesn't just begin right here. It actually goes all the way back to God's promise to Abraham, God's promise to David, what God has done throughout the people of Israel, and indeed others that we read about in this list that aren't Israelites. So that what he's doing, and this is probably the hardest thing I'll try to get across tonight because it involves some knowledge of language and some knowledge of Genesis, is to connect what Matthew's doing to what John's doing. Most of us are more familiar with John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we know right away, oh, in the beginning, that takes us all the way back to Genesis. So John's doing the same thing Jesus does, but in a high theological fashion. Matthew's doing the same thing. Because when he says, Biblos Geneseos, the book of the Genesis, that's the Greek for what's going on in chapter 1, verse 1, he is connecting to the way the book of Genesis is structured. The book of Genesis is structured around 11 toledot formulas. Toledot is the word in Hebrew that is then translated in the Greek Septuagint, the translation, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, with Genesoas, or if you make the hard G soft, Genesis. It's where we get our title for Genesis. It's actually the Greek for how it begins. If we went by the Hebrew, we'd call Genesis Toledot. Because Toledot is a way that the author of Genesis has structured his book in order that you can see that the whole thing builds off of lines of family and their history and their relationships to one another. So the Toledot of the heavens and the earth. And then when Adam comes on the scene, the book of the Toledot of Adam. And then all of Adam's descendants are listed. The book of the Toledot of Noah and all of his descendants are listed. What Matthew's doing is he's giving us the book of the Toledot of Jesus connecting to Genesis' story, because he's taking us back to Abram and others. But now he's saying, instead of talking about the book of the Toledot of Jesus and listing his descendants, which is how all of these work, we're seeing all of Jesus' ancestors all climaxing in their fulfillment, which is his favorite word, in Jesus Christ. You see it also, and this is where I want to look smart to you, because I there's a certain vanity in me. I'd like to think that my seminary education paid off in some way, and who else can I do this with but you? I can't do this with my friends around a football game. No one cares. But there's kata mateon, which is according to Matthew, and this is verse 1 in the Greek, which is the language in which our New Testament's originally written. And it reads like this, and you can make out some of the letters. Biblos Geneseos, Jesu Christu, Wiu David, Wiu Abram. The book of the Genesis, or the book of the origin, the book of the beginnings of Jesus the Christ, son of David, son of Abram. Now, there's the important word, Geneseos, which is the Greek word for Toledot. This is not the book of Adam, the book of the Toledot, the Biblos Geneseos of Adam. This is the Biblos Geneseos of Jesus Christ, which is to say, Matthew's telling the story of a new beginning, but it is a new beginning, because that's what Genesis means, beginnings that's rooted in the old. Which is very, very important, because you got to remember, many of Matthew's early readers are people who were Jews and deeply embedded in the Jewish tradition, but they've embraced Christ, and as the partings of the ways occurs and the Jewish Christians become more and more parted from Judaism and become more and more outcast, and there's more hostility between the two, one of the questions that the Jewish Christians might have is, do we have any connection to our past at all? And Matthew is saying, you have a deep connection, although something new has occurred too. So that there's the old and there's the new, and the new is building on the old, so that you're not abandoning your tradition. You instead have discovered the one toward whom the whole thing was leading all along. And building on that, now we have the new Genesis, the new beginning. The new beginning of Christ, a beginning of God's fulfillment of all God had promised and that had been woven and worked out through the ancestors, has come to its climax in Jesus. So it's a very interesting thing Matthew is doing there in order to connect the past to the present and to say the past isn't disposable. You can't do like some want to do, get rid of the Old Testament. It's just, you know, it's just a cumbersome, weighty book. Matthew's saying, bring it all in. And value it and honor it, but something new is happening that's building off of it. And because it's new, some of that old wineskin's going to have to be got rid of, which Jesus will talk about. Because it's new, this one's going to call us to a higher righteousness. Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter my kingdom. It's a higher righteousness. It's newer. It's different. It builds on the old. It honors the old. But it's moving in a fresh new direction. A direction that's going to challenge our friend Joseph here before this chapter's out. And it'll bring us full circle. So that's what Matthew's doing here in the beginning. He's speaking of a new Genesis. He's using this genealogy, but that's not all that's interesting about this genealogy. From the very beginning, he's whet the reader's appetite by giving three messianic titles. You do see two of them at least. One of them we're so familiar with, we forget it's a messianic title. You see in verse 1, son of David, right? You see son of Abram. The one that sometimes fails to capture our attention, because it's so obvious, is not Jesus. That's just, Jesus is just a common name at the time. It's a way you say Joshua or Yeshua. It's Christ, which is not Jesus' last name. Always remember that. Jesus' last name is not Christ, all right? Jesus' last name, if anything, is Jesus, son of Mary, to be quite honest, adopted by Joseph. And that's the problem in the second half of this chapter. It's Jesus, son of Mary, and so Jesus' last name isn't Christ. Christ is a Hebrew word that means anointed one. It is a word that has this deep resonance throughout the whole of the Hebrew Bible, or what we call our Old Testament, where the priest, the prophets, the kings, they were all anointed with oil as a way to set them apart for sacred service. But as Israel moved forward in history, that word began to evolve more and more into a unique way to speak of a Davidic king, an ideal king. Someone who would come, who'd be the Messiah, the Savior, the one that would come and fulfill the promise given to David and the promise offered to Abraham. And those two other titles are so much easier to get, because Son of David draws us back to 1 Samuel 7, or 2 Samuel 7, I think. It's one of those where God promises David, you will have a descendant sitting on the throne forever. Now, we've gone through the Old Testament. We've been through the exile where there's centuries without anyone on the throne. But David was promised a descendant on the throne forever. That's what this is hearkening to. And then Son of Abraham takes us all the way back to what Israel forgot again and again, that God had promised through Abraham to bring a descendant who would bless the nations. Your seed will be a blessing to the nations. It's very easy to get inbred and the blessing's all for us and we're God's chosen ones and no one's else. No, you're chosen to a mission, and that mission is to bring God's blessing to the world. And so you have all of these messianic terms woven together so that your original reader is looking at this saying, oh my gosh, right away Matthew's just laying out his cards. Jesus is the Christ. He is the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. Now, Matthew wants to connect him to the whole story of Israel, and he does it with this long, structured genealogy, which has three different sections, and you may notice them. The NIV puts them in a list and allows you to see the sections. The NRSV puts them in paragraphs, so if you'll note the sections, so we don't have to read all the names, verse 2 through 6b takes 6a takes us from Abraham to King David. And then you notice in the middle of 6b, David begins and takes us all the way to the end of verse 11, the exile to Babylon. And then verse 12 begins with after the exile to Babylon and takes us all the way to Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus. And then in order to support that threefold structure, verse 17 makes it very clear for us. Thus there were 14 generations from Abraham to David, and there were 14 from David to the exile, and 14 from the exile to the Christ. Now, literally that's not true. There's far more years than the generations there, but what Matthew's doing is he's structuring this in a way that there's a wonderful synchronicity and harmony in order to show us God's sovereignty over history, and that in the midst of all of these times, God's still at work bringing to fulfillment the coming of the promised one. But there's something even more interesting about this structure, and that is it's rooted around the idea of Messiah, the idea of king. Because you notice everyone in the first list, they're not a king, but they get us to a king. So it's from no king to a king, from king to no king, from no king to a king. Are you following? This might help if you see just some of the names. If you look at the first segment, verses 2 through 6, many of those names we recognize. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Boaz, Jesse the father of King David. A lot of really good stories of the patriarchs and actions there. But the way that Matthew wants to put those together, they all lead to the king. And there's King David. Now, I'll test you. Everyone in the second section, 6b through verse 11, every single name has one thing in common. Every single one has one thing in common. Do you know what it is? They're all kings. Very good. Very good. And that's important. Israel would know this as they're reading this. Every single name's a king. And the tragedy is the way that ends. Exile to Babylon. And then no king. Wait, the promise to David, the promise of the Messiah, it's seemingly over. And then in the last section, there's one or two names you can recognize. Zerubbabel, we read about him in verse 13. Other than that, many of these names are lost to us as far as their significance, what they did. And the reason is, there's no king. The people are in exile. I mean, these are tragic and traumatic times here. These are what were called the 400 silent years, when a prophet had not arisen in Israel. And so it culminates in verse 16, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom, now that whom in the Greek is feminine. So it's the antecedent to the pronoun is Mary, of whom was born Jesus. So Jesus isn't connected to Joseph yet. Jesus isn't in this line because Jesus is connected to Mary. Who is called the Christ? So, from no king to king, from king to no king, from no king to Jesus the Messiah. And that's why it's shaped like this, in order to show us the whole weave and the roller coaster of history that has preceded Jesus, and how in the midst of even exile and disappointment, God's promise hasn't been lost. God's fulfillment is still coming through. It's a very interesting thing, and again, this would be exciting to the original readers. But there's one other very curious thing about this genealogy that's actually the funnest part of it, because it also segues us into the story of Joseph. You have four women listed in this genealogy, which isn't surprising to us because we're modern, we're progressive, we're feminist, we understand the equal role of women, and I truly and wholly believe in that. And I'm grateful that we're at that point in history. But at the time of the Bible's writing, to have a female in the genealogy, it doesn't happen. They're not part of it because the descendants come through the male. So why put any females in here? It's just not something that would happen. It's not even that it was uncommon. It would not happen. So when the original readers are hearing four female names, they have to wonder, oh my gosh. It's like, you know, West Point Academy, you open it up and there's some females. Although I think West Point Academy is now open to all, correct? So that dates me. You'd have to go back a few years. But you get the idea. So here's what's going on here. We got four females. Why are they included? What is it about them that merits their inclusion? You have Tamar in verse 3, Rahab and Ruth in verse 5, and Bathsheba's not named, but the way Bathsheba is described actually makes David look bad. Because it says in verse 6b, David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. So before you get too hard on all those politicians that are corrupt and crooked, don't forget your history. Don't forget David, who was as dirty as they all get. He was also great, godly. How's that work? Sinner and saint. But it's just how life rolls. And Israel doesn't shy away from the dark side of its history, and they don't write off David because of the dark side of his history. So what's interesting here is we got four names, and three of the names are Gentiles for sure. We don't know whether Bathsheba was, but it's certain that Tamar was. Rahab certainly was. Ruth was a Moabitess who was from a cursed race, according to Israel's tradition. The Moabites had come about because Lot didn't escape when he should have escaped. He went into a cave. He had incest with his daughters, and out came the Moabites. So they were always held up as an accursed race that had a sordid past. And then you have Bathsheba, who was the victim of David's lust. What's interesting about all four of these women is that they were all involved in a scandal. Scandals that weren't their fault, but scandals nonetheless. And surrounding that scandal was a certain amount of sexual impropriety, again, that wasn't their fault for the most part. Although there's one that, until she had another opportunity, it was the way she had to make her living. So that you have Tamar, for example, whose husband dies, and Judah, the great Judah, from which we get the lion of the tribe of Judah, Judah, the original Judah, would not give her one of his sons so that she could marry, so that you could have a levirate marriage. And so she called him to account. She posed as a prostitute. She lured him, because Judah was just a dog. She lured him, and once he realized what she'd done, that she'd lured him with her wiles, she exposed him, and then he had to get her a husband. So she took matters into her own hands and made sure she got the husband that was due her from him. Rahab didn't pose as a prostitute. She was. But she also worked alongside the Hebrew spies in order to help the Israelites enter into the promised land and the whole walls of Jericho thing. Ruth was one of those Moabites, considered a cursed race, and yet when her husband died, she clung to her mother-in-law and said, "Your God will be my God. Where you go, I'll go." And she clung wholeheartedly, and she was able to capture the affections of a kinsman redeemer, and she's very forward in doing that. She's taking matters in her own hands, and it all works to her end, and she becomes the great-great-grandmother of David. And Bathsheba, of course, at first is the victim of David's lust, but eventually becomes the mother of wise King Solomon and is held in high honor for that very, very role. So you have women that are included, and they're not included as the old school used to say. Well, the women are included to show that God does accept sinners. I mean, there are sermons like that. You know, they're all sinners, so God... And they forget, hold on, David's in this list. Manasseh's in this list. Child sacrifice, anyone? You know, so that's silly. That's just a stupid thing. Instead, they're in the list to do a couple things. To show the Gentile inclusion in the impure line of Judah. That it's not quite as pure as you'd think. There are Gentiles included in this. It's also there to show that God works not just through kings or patriarchs, but through women and outsiders and Gentiles. And God even works through controversial events and things that you might not expect, that God is able to bring some things out of, you know, situations that are horrific. So that you got this very interesting way that God is working and weaving even through these very difficult and challenging situations. But the most important reason that all four connected and all four are here is because none of them would have been the right marriage partner, at least initially. All of them had that hint of scandal connected to sexual impropriety around them enough that it raised questions initially until they were able to gain the honor of the Jewish tradition, and they have that honor. But initially there's some scandal. Well, guess who else has a hint of scandal around potential sexual impropriety? Mary. And we're just about to read about her. And there's a reason those stories are included, to say, you know, God is involved even in what you're about to read. As odd and as strange and as troubling a situation as this could be, Mary stands in the line of some very honorable women who initially were seen to be scandalous. So, that then connects us to the second portion of chapter 1, which is all we're going to cover tonight. And in order to see the challenge of this birth of Jesus Christ, what you need to do is realize how verse 16 ends. Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, which means Jesus wasn't born of Joseph. And then you come down to verse 18. This is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph, but before they came together, she was found to be with child through the Holy Spirit. So Joseph is not his father, and all of a sudden you see the challenge of connecting the genealogy to Jesus. And the challenge comes because Matthew 1, 18 through 25 isn't a cute, nice, wonderful Christmas story. It's not a story even where we read about the birth of Christ that much. It starts with, now, the birth of Christ, and at the end we read that he was born, but that's it. Mostly it's about Joseph and the challenge that he has to face, and whether he's going to take Mary or to do the righteous thing and get rid of her. Because as far as he can tell, she's been unfaithful. And according to the law, and because he's a righteous man and he cares about Torah, and this is seen as a good thing, the Torah says that he needs to discard her. He indeed needs to perhaps publicly humiliate her. So, if he's going to be righteous and obey the law, something needs to be done about this situation that seems to involve infidelity. So what's interesting about this second part of chapter 1 is the question that it really raises for us is, how can Jesus be the son of David if Joseph is not his father? And what's very curious and interesting to me, because let me just, I'll be as blunt as I can. I have no problem with virgin conception. There are modernists that think that, you know, these things are just so stupid and weird, and they let reason overrule all of their perspectives of God, and whatever's not reasonable, God can't do, because obviously God can't go beyond reason, where I say God is welcome to not make sense to me. God is, if God can create this cosmos, God can do a virgin conception. No problem. Okay? So, when I say I believe in the virgin birth, I believe in the virgin birth. I believe in it. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bat an eye. I have no problem saying that and still believing in science and all the things that come from there as well. So that what happens in this text is the virgin conception, because that's really what it is, not a virgin birth. She's a virgin who gives birth, but it's a virgin conception. The virgin conception is not immediately a dogma of faith, as much as it's a problem to deal with. Do you follow? In this text, it's a problem because this is how things happen. You know, this is new Genesis. This is something new. This is building off the old, but it's something new. And because it's not how things happen in the world as we know it, we have to then say, well, she just must have been unfaithful. And Joseph is just the kind of kindly chap that he marries her anyway. And that's how some progressives will tell the story. Well, he just puts up with the fact that she's been unfaithful and Jesus is just a bastard child. You know, that's just how it rolls, baby. I don't follow that line of thinking. And sorry for the B word, but that actually fits. That wasn't said as a pejorative. Right? Right? Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. We got confirmants here. And I don't, Pastor Rich, okay. Don't want that going on. So, how can Jesus be son of David when Joseph's not his father? So here's what this text is about. Let's look at it very quickly because we're running out of time. Verse 19, Joseph has some challenges. Joseph's righteous. Because Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man, but he's also compassionate. He didn't want to expose her to public disgrace. He has every right to. He could completely humiliate her. And that's what's wonderful about Joseph. He is completely devoted to the law. So don't get in your head that, you know, if you're devoted to the law, you must be a legalistic Pharisee. No, he's righteous. He loves God's law. He wants to keep it. As far as he can tell, God's will is you've got to discard her. She's been unfaithful. But he doesn't want to humiliate her, although he has every right to. He could impound her dowry. He could make her life a living train wreck. But he doesn't want to do that. So he decides, I want to not publicly disgrace her, so I'll divorce her quietly. I'll make sure that this engagement goes through the proper channels and it doesn't result in a marriage, and we'll stop the proceedings and she won't have to bear any shame. And you get a very interesting picture of Joseph at this point. But then something happens. Verse 20. After he'd considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, look, son of David. Matthew wants to emphasize and underscore. You see, that's the problem. How can Jesus be son of David if he's not Joseph's child? Because Mary doesn't matter in that culture. Are you following? So Joseph, son of David, in order that we surely get the point, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, which is to say, you listen, you ready? Don't be afraid to break the law. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to take that Torah and say there's a higher righteousness. I honor the old, but there's a new wineskin. I honor the old, but unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you may not enter the kingdom. So Joseph is given the first challenge to the higher righteousness here. Don't be afraid to take her as your wife, which means you're going to break the Torah, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. This is something brand new, God's power moving in a new way. She'll give birth to a son, and you're to give him the name Jesus, Yeshua. It's a common name, but it means Yahweh saves, because he'll save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill, because that's what this book is about, what the Lord had said through the prophet, the virgin will be with child, she'll give birth to a son, and they'll call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. God's saving power entering into a sinful humanity, into the real world, in order to break forth with God's power in a new way that has never been done before. This is a brand new movement of God. That's why the virgin conception is dogma. Because God is doing something through the God-man, through God with us. Not just a great prophet, not just a man with a deep spiritual consciousness, but through God with us. Because this is one who is conceived by the Spirit and by a woman, unlike anyone else. So that's what's going on here. Joseph hears this. He's told, don't be afraid to break the law. Verse 24, when Joseph woke up, he did what the angel said. And he took Mary as his wife, which means at that point, ta-da! Jesus is the son of David. He legally pronounces Jesus as his own. He names him as with a name, which is a way of declaring his acceptance and love, that he's following through with this whole thing. And he legally adopts Jesus as his own, making Jesus officially a descendant of the line of David. We'll finish this out, but he had no union with her until she gave birth to a son. And this, you know, I love Catholics, you know that. But I think this verse is almost the death knell. Had no union until. Which means after she had a son, Joseph did not have to live in perpetual frustration. Because sex isn't bad. All right? And he gave him, Pastor Rich also told us, and he gave him the name Jesus. All right. So, we're done here with this last question. What then is the significance of the virgin conception? Why is it there? And the answer was found at the beginning. That's why I spent so much time with Biblos Geneseos, the book of the Genesis. What's happening? Why is the virgin conception there? Why is it important? Because it's a new Genesis. And if we're going to introduce Jesus, God is moving in a new way, unlike ever before, but in a way that's been prepared by the patriarchs and by the prophets and by the kings and all that has preceded, in a way that fulfills and honors the past, but breaks forth in a new movement of God's Spirit unlike any before in the present, and then unfolds into our Pentecost and into our lives in the present as well. That God is moving forward and bringing forth the power of God into the human situation in a way unlike ever before. And with that introduction, we're ready to move into chapters 2 with the visit of the Magi and Herod's hatred of a Christ child. Because when God moves, there's always acceptance and there's always hostility and resistance. All right, so that's what we'll move into next week. But that's what we got for tonight. Worship team, come on forward. Any quick questions or comments? Sorry, I didn't mean to take up this much time, but I knew we were trying to get through a lot tonight. Questions? Elizabeth back there. And say it real loud and I'll repeat it. Oh, we got mics.
Women in the genealogy. One of them was Tamar.
Uh-huh.
This confused me. Wasn't Tamar the one daughter of David?
No, that's another Tamar.
Okay.
That's another Tamar. Yes, this is Tamar, who is the wife of Onan. And if you want to read a weird story, read why Onan dies. Or seriously, if you've ever heard of Onanism, her first husband dies. And that's why she has to lure Judah by taking on the status of a prostitute and tricking him. No one's heard of that.
No.
You guys need to know the dirty parts of your Bible better. All right. Chris.
Maybe we should rethink congregation being here on Wednesday night.
No. Believe me, we're past all the sordid stories. Yeah. David's important because he is the man after God's own heart. He is the first, if you remember, Saul's the first king, but Saul never really aligns with God's will, Saul is so self-driven and stubborn, and God tries to correct him again and again, and Saul refuses to. And you remember, Saul was beautiful. He was heads above other people. He was the one you'd expect would be a good king. Where David was the runt of the litter, the youngest of seven brothers. And David, for all of his faults, and they are there, also was a man after God's own heart. And after every fault, he eventually came to his senses and confessed his sin and tried to make it right. And that's why he's a man after God's own heart. Not because he's perfect, but because he deals with his sin as a righteous person should. He deals with it, he confesses it, he repents, he tries to make restitution, he tries to make it right. But he's the sweet psalmist of Israel. He just loves God's house. Remember, he wants to build God's temple, but God says, no, you're a man of bloodshed, which is interesting. You know, you've shed so much blood, your hands can't build the temple so that your son will after you. So it's very interesting, but he's very, very important. He's a very defining figure. I'd almost argue that if you take the four main figures of the Old Testament, it would be Abraham, and then Moses, and then David, and probably one of the prophets. But those are the big, big players. You know, it's like Luke and Leah. You know, they're the ones that matter more than anybody. Not Boba Fett and others that are just bit players. Although Boba Fett's cool.